Welcome to Cult Movie Cult, where we watch and discuss the horrific, the obscure, and the flat-out strange from the other side of cinema. I'm Mark Dickerson.
And I'm Jeremy Fink. And this is part four in our series, Cinema Slackers, where we take a psychedelic trip through some of cinema's greatest wanderers and drifters. Kick back, roll one up, and listen in. Today we'll be discussing the 1998 film The Big Lebowski, written and directed by the Coen brothers.
Where's the money, Lebowski?
That rug really tied the room together, did it not?
Fucking A.
This guy peed on it.
Donnie, please.
I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. So that's what you call me, you know? His dudeness, or duder, or, you know, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
Nobody fucks with the Jesus.
Sex, the physical act of love. Coitus. Do you like it?
Has the whole world gone crazy?
I like your style, dude. There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
The Big Lebowski, starring Jeff Bridges, follows the story of Jeffrey the Dude Lebowski, who is a middle-aged slacker, who gets mistaken for another man with the same name, Jeffrey Lebowski, whose wife owes some people some money. These men come over to the dude's house, and they assault him and pee on his rug, and then leave him all alone, the dude being upset about his rug because it really tied the room together, goes and tries to find the Big Lebowski, the real Jeffrey Lebowski, and all kinds of chaos ensues because Bunny, the wife of the Big Lebowski, gets kidnapped, or maybe kidnapped, and the dude ends up caught up in this whole very confusing mystery that's kind of based on the writings of Raymond Chandler, who I actually literally have The Big Sleep on my desk right now as we speak. But this is just a really wild movie where the plot kind of doesn't matter, but the ride is pretty fantastic.
And it's really hard to not just start quoting lines when you're talking about this movie.
Yes.
That's all you want to do because it's so quotable.
Well, this might be, just before we dig in here, just because this is Cult Movie Cult, and this is probably the most cultish movie we will discuss on this podcast.
I was actually going to say that exact same thing because one of the main factors of a cult film is rewatchability, right? Mm-hmm. So this one has it in space. I mean, you could watch this movie over and over.
Yeah.
And it only gets better.
And there's literally a religion called dudism.
Yes.
Based on this.
Is.
This movie actually kind of has a cult. It's not just a cult movie. It actually has a cult.
So. You're right. Like, the lifestyle of the dude is kind of its own cult. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. So this film, The Big Lebowski, is set in the early 90s. A time period we've been exploring a little bit already with our last couple of films we talked about in this series. Mm-hmm. This is when the idea of the slacker seemed to be at the forefront. Everyone was kind of thinking about it, I guess. This is the quintessential, not only the quintessential cult film, but the quintessential slacker, I would say.
Yeah.
Maybe the biggest slacker we've discussed so far. Just his whole philosophy on life is that he doesn't want to be involved. You know,
he's basically a Taoist.
He just wants to float through, and I mean, he's a pacifist, which he brings up a lot. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to be involved in any conflict, which is obviously doesn't work out for him because he's getting involved in all kinds of things throughout the film. So what was your first impression going back to seeing this film again?
Well, this is one I've seen a lot of times, as a lot of people will. And if you haven't seen this movie, don't listen to this podcast right now. Go watch this movie and then listen to the podcast, just because you can't even begin to understand it if you haven't seen the movie. It's just one of those ones. Like, mm-hmm. we'll be talking gibberish and quoting a lot of stuff that sounds like it means nothing.
Exactly.
More
than usual, anyway.
Normally we talk about our favorite moments at the end, and there are a lot of favorite moments in this, but I think the one for me, and it's not even a funny moment, but just the opening of the film with the tumbleweed.
I know, there's something about that, isn't there?
It's just so beautiful because it's so clever. You know, it totally embodies who this character is going to be. The song choice is perfect. The voiceover narration.
Mm-hmm. And he's like the wandering drifter, a legend. Yeah.
And it's also the idea that it's set in Los Angeles, so it's a Western, which I'm kind of have this theory that every film the Coen brothers have made is a Western.
I know. You know, I had a note here that they had dipped their toes in the Western genre before this, but I mean, they've done full on Westerns, obviously. And I just watched their newest film. I don't know if you've seen it.
Oh, I love that movie. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which grew on me more and more as I
watched
it.
Yeah. I thought that was fantastic.
Really
kind of
crazy and great. And that's very much obviously a Western. So they've done it before, and this film is very much, it's interesting because you mentioned last time, Jeremy, this is almost a noir, and I think it is. It's kind of a in the vein of a detective story, but it also has that Western element where, you know, you're looking at a legend, basically someone who just kind of wanders and drifts through from town to town, but is also a lazy slob, which is kind of a funny juxtaposition there. So we have that. We have the noir influence. We have just a slacker genre in general influence. And the Coen brothers are very much about genre. And I think the juxtaposition there of how intelligent they are and their writing, how, you know, how good their scripts are with their love and adoration of specific genres, I think is always very fascinating. And you see it very much here. And actually there's a lot of parallels between this and Inherent Vice that when I saw that film, it made me think of this film a lot, where it's a detective story, but also slacker. And in the film is not really concerned with the actual mystery or the actual, the motive for for what's going on. It's more just everything around it. And I think that's what's unique about this.
Well, film. On a side note, I was actually kind of almost surprised when I saw Inherent Vice, because I love Paul Thomas Anderson, and I was almost surprised that he made that movie with the knowledge that The Big Lebowski already existed.
I agree. It's
And I think Inherent Vice is great, but I think that this movie really just
nails that.
Tone. Yeah, it did everything it needed to.
So as you said, a case of mistaken identity is what sets everything off here. So Jeffrey Lebowski, or the Dude, as he calls himself,
as we will be referring to him from here on out to avoid confusion.
Call him, the Dude. He is just kind of like we said, a wanderer, a drifter. He goes bowling, hangs out, listens to music, and smokes J's. That's pretty much it.
Drinks
White Russians, Caucasians, as he calls them,
Ruskies.
So that's his life. That's what he does. He just hangs out. He hangs out with a couple people. One of them, Walter, played by John Goodman, who I think we need to devote an entire section to because he's just so great in this film.
Could devote an entire podcast to.
Exactly. And Steve Buscemi as Donnie. The two of them are always with him at the bowling alley and they hang out a lot. But other than that, you know, he doesn't do very much. He just hangs out. And until one day where our film begins, where people break into his house and think that they keep calling him Lebowski, which is his name, but he soon realizes they're referring to a different Lebowski. After, of course, they flushed his head down into the toilet and peed on his rug. So, and that in the rug is kind of the thing that, like, the running gag for the movie is they keep going back to the rug, and that's really all that he cares about. The Dude, he just wants compensation for the rug because it really tied the room together. So eventually he. The Dude meets up with the other Lebowski, or I believe he's actually summoned there. Because as his character floats through everything, he wouldn't take it upon himself to do this, which is always interesting to me when you have a main character who is very passive and he's not the one driving the plot. It's almost everything else around him. I always find that interesting.
Although I will say the Dude is surprisingly pissy. You know, like he's a little salty. Yeah. Like there's a lot of moments in this movie, you know, for someone who claims to be a pacifist.
He gets pissed off at everything,
which is kind of also interesting and indicative of the time. I mean, there's the clip in the opening scene when he's in this grocery store buying milk, which he pays for milk that's like a dollar with a check, which is hilarious. and so indicative of who he is. But he's watching this clip with George Bush and George Bush Sr. And George Bush Sr. is saying, you know, that will not stand.
This
aggression will not stand. And I think that, like, Lebowski's, like, attitude, because he's not, like, for someone who is such a laid-back dude, he really gets angry about everything. Mm-hmm. Not aggressively angry, but I think he kind of embodies that time a little bit. Where
he's just annoyed by everything.
Yeah, we've moved, you know, we've been through the 60s, we've been through the peace-love movement, but then we also got through the Cold War. The Cold War has just ended. So it was kind of supposed to be this time of, like, peace and relaxation, but this guy is kind of just feeling weird and out of place and things kind of annoy him, and wants to be able to have that peace and relaxation, but then everything gets on his nerves.
The very idea of conflict is a main factor in this movie, because you have the Desert Storm significance. They refer to it. I mean, that's what's going on around the time, or I guess it was right before, or no, it was probably
it was right around the time. yeah
Yeah, so the war in Iraq with Saddam Hussein, it gets brought up a lot in a lot of different ways, and it's very, I think, important to the film. At first, it seems like it's not, but the more you watch the film, you kind of realize how important it is to what's going on, and just, like I said, that idea of conflict and the way that the dude is trying to avoid any conflict in his life. It's just like, you know, those two things together is really what the main conflict in this film is mm-hmm. the fact that he doesn't want the conflict.
Yeah, he just wants to do his thing.
He wants to do his thing, but he just can't. And he gets annoyed by it, I guess. Mm. So the script for The Big Lebowski was written around the same time as Barton Fink, actually. And that was in 1991, which makes a lot of sense because this film is set in the early 90s, whereas it was made the late 90s, came out in 1998. So they had been wanting to make it for years, and as the Coen brothers do, I looked into their process a little bit, and apparently they'll start writing a film, get stuck somewhere, and they'll go work on another film. And mm-hmm. then when they come back, they somehow have the solution to their problem, and they'll finish that film.
Which is a very Lebowski way of dealing with things.
Exactly. It's like, all right, well, man,
we're stuck, just go do something else, and we'll come back eventually.
But obviously it's been working out for you.
Yeah, clearly. So. Yeah.
So they use that approach here. They made Fargo, which is probably one of their best known, if not their best known film. And after Fargo, they finally got to work on making this, and they had the cast in mind when they wrote it. And the cast is just perfect for this, by the way.
Unbelievable. I mean,
you can't beat this cast. Jeff Bridges as the dude is perfect. John Goodman, I guess we could talk about that now. He's just playing the friend Walter. He's actually an amalgamation of different people that the Coen brothers knew, one of them being the director John Milius, actually.
Interesting.
Which is very interesting. Yeah, because he's very militaristic and aggressive, and he's always into something new, like how Walter's, you know, he's talking about he's devoted to the Jewish faith all of a sudden, and, you know, watching his ex-girlfriend's dog. You know, he's always got something going on in his life.
And what's interesting with Walter to me, and I think a lot of the characters in this, is that they're these absurdist, kind of in a similar way that we were talking about with Clerks, is that it's all these absurdist people who on the surface seem like they're just the way they are because it's funny. But then you kind of dig a little deeper and you see the real kind of traumas and stuff that they're dealing with. Like, you know, Walter is a veteran who can't let go of his time in the military. And that could easily be in and of itself a really sad drama. You know,
he talks about Vietnam, even though he was never in Vietnam.
Yeah. He talks about it constantly. You know, it's like, he's such a broken, troubled guy. I mean, yeah.
Walter is insane. He's the type of man who pulls a gun over the rules of bowling, on a friend. So
yeah, he's so violent.
And he's like shouting, "Has everyone gone crazy?" As he's pulling a gun on his friend over bowling. So, you know, that's the kind of character he is. So he's just very entertaining to watch. And John Goodman, as always, is great in the role. And he's also the perfect friend / foil for the dude, mm-hmm. I notice.
He
gets under the dude's skin like no one else.
Yeah.
Which is so funny because they keep going back to each other and they're always hanging out. And, mm-hmm. everyone also has that friend where, they're almost annoying in a way, but you get something out of the relationship, and I think that the dude does get something out of being with Walter and vice versa.
What do you think? So Steve Buscemi plays the role of Donnie. Where do you think Donnie fits into that dynamic?
So Donnie, until I never really knew. He was always kind of a mystery to me. I was always wondering why is this character even there? Because he says very little, and when he does, he's told to shut up. So I was wondering about that, but then I was looking when I was researching the movie, I noticed something that made a lot of sense, and it's almost like the character of Donnie is almost an in joke with the Coen brothers, because the previous movie before this, Fargo, as I mentioned, Steve Buscemi was also in that movie, and he talks a mile a minute in that one. He's always saying something, he's always blabbing away. So this was sort of a joke with the Coen brothers. When they gave him this role, they wanted him to say almost absolutely nothing, and when he does, he never knows what's going on, and he's always being told to shut the fuck up. So that's the big, it's almost like a big joke in a way, which makes sense. But also there's a sweetness to Donnie and innocence there, which is kind of different than everything else that's going on. So I think there's that. You know what I mean? Just to have variety in the characters, I think it's important to have Donnie there.
He kind of fits somewhere in the middle. I have heard a theory, which I don't think I wouldn't give weight to because there's evidence in the movie that it's not true, but a theory that Donnie is like a figment of Walter's PTSD imagination.
Yeah, I could see that.
But I could see it, but I think the personally,
dude does say a couple of things.
Yeah, Donnie does get ignored, unless they're both just on some wild trip. But the ending of the whole movie is just a wild trip, so who knows?
The stranger, the narrator, could be a hallucination as well.
That's very true. I think my favorite character, though, in this entire movie might be Maude Lebowski, played by Julianne Moore.
Oh, she's great too, yeah.
So Maude Lebowski is the daughter, correct?
Yes.
It's hard to keep track of this. So
of the Big Lebowski.
Yeah, so for anyone who's like an obsessive Lebowski fan, if we get any of these character relationships confused, I apologize in advance. There's a lot of them. Mm-hmm. It's hard.
Well, I think part is they want it to be confusing.
Yeah, they want it to be confusing, and that's the point. But she's so Maude Lebowski is the daughter of the Big Lebowski, mm-hmm. and then therefore also the stepdaughter of Bunny Lebowski, strangely, which I always thought was a weird detail. But she's kind of this artist character,
quintessential artist character, neurotic.
She kind of talks like Katharine Hepburn.
Yeah,
it's very bizarre, but I could never quite figure out her place in the whole thing, Maude. But she's just so full of like life, and Julianne Moore, admittedly, is probably my favorite actress of all time.
She's so good.
She's so good in literally everything she does.
Safe is one of my favorites ever. So,
but she's such, and there's just so many quirky characters in this, and I know the way we're talking about this right now, we're kind of jumping around a little bit, but I feel like it's one of those movies where. You kind of have to absorb it as the whole. You can't really just take it and start at the beginning and then go to the end and only talk about it that way.
Yeah.
Because certain moments that happen in the last 10-15 minutes of the film inform moments that happen in the first 10 minutes of the film. And I think that's one of the reasons that it's kind of held up so well is the fact that even though it's confusing, it's kind of just working on you the whole time, and it's just so immersive in the way that maybe like a Fellini movie might be or a David Lynch movie, not in that it's dark, but that they take you into this world that's kind of close to our own, but also just so totally far removed. You know, it's also beautiful that it's set in Los Angeles because it's a movie that has so much to do with movies, you know, like, I mean, because the first time I saw The Big Lebowski was right when I was kind of first starting to make movies, and then going back and watching it now years later, having seen a lot of the old Hollywood movies and the noir films noir that this would have been influenced by, there's so many little tiny intricate details and so many tropes that they're playing off of, but just totally recontextualizing.
So many characters, like you said. Now I'm thinking about all the different characters. Like you have DeJesus.
DeJesus, yeah.
You have the nihilist. I mean, you have all these, you know, crazy characters that are just, and Philip Seymour Hoffman playing the assistant. So, and as the plot gets more convoluted, I think the film actually, I mean, obviously that's a goal for the Coens. They want it to be too much for the dude. They want it to be almost too much for the audience. They want it to get a little crazy and complicated, and it definitely does. And it only makes the situations more ridiculous, I think, as it goes. So to kind of go back to what the plot is, I'm not going to go focus on it too much.
Yeah, it's hard.
I just want to go. So the jumping off point is, you know, the people break in Piona's rug. He goes, is summoned to a mansion where a very rich, really very rich man who is also named Jeffrey Lebowski resides. And I think that is like the core of it, because there's a lot of, I'll get into this later, but so the fact that this man is very successful and wealthy, contrasting him with the dude, that is also another big aspect of this film. And you know, this guy needs his help. He's asking him because his wife, he thinks, has been kidnapped, and he thinks that the men who broke into the other Lebowski's apartment are the ones responsible. So because of this, the dude gets caught up in it and involved, and because he, you know, he'll get some money for it. So he's like, whatever, man, okay, what do you want me to do, drop off a briefcase with some money in it? Okay. You know, he thinks it's going to be easy, and then obviously it just spirals off from there.
That's hardly
wrong. Which the Coen brothers, they've done this in a couple other movies. Burn After Reading is the first one that comes to mind, where they explore that same idea of something just kind of a plot taking hold and just going off the rails.
Yeah.
And all these different characters getting caught up in it, and something that started out so simple gets so complicated to the point where even the characters in the film don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
And that's very much at display here. So that's, as far as the plot goes, that's all I'm going to discuss, because I think that's all you really need to get the idea of what's going on.
There's something about, you know, porno movies being made.
Yeah, there's a whole, like,
log jamming. There's a guy named Jackie Treehorn who is maybe funding the porno movies, but is also kind of this classic noir rich man character.
And that's all related to Maude Lebowski, his daughter, and
it's really all over the place. There's something about the Knudsens and a toe missing. It's very confusing.
The missing toe.
but let's, rather than trying to go on about the plot, because I think ultimately
we're done with the plot.
we're going to end up nowhere. It's just going to be confusing. What do you think some of the themes are in this movie? What do you think the Coen brothers are trying to express?
So there's a lot here. One of the main things I was thinking about during this rewatch of the film is the idea of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
When he meets the other Lebowski, who's very successful, and he's just walking around his mansion looking into the mirror of the man of the year of the Time magazine cover that he has, and a lot of their dialogue is just, you know, because the other Lebowski is always calling him a bum, and he screams at one point, "The bums will always lose." So it's almost like a commentary on a very much the slacker, which is what we're discussing. You know what I mean? It's like the slacker versus someone whose main concern is money and capitalism. So I think that conflict there is also a big part of it. What do you think, though?
Yeah, well, I think that's interesting, because I think that when capitalism is discussed, particularly, like, I just read a book by Ayn Rand, who's kind of like the
capitalist.
she's like the capitalist and the, to the point of being a little radical, individualist. And I think what's interesting here is capitalism to me is a theme, but also the idea of individualism. And I say individualism meaning you have a lot of people who are mostly functioning for themselves. You know, if you look at this movie, there aren't really people doing anything for anyone else in this entire movie. You know, like I think that the Big Lebowski mostly wants his wife back to avoid a mess. You know, and to avoid financial.
Or when they do do something for someone else, they usually botch it somehow.
They botch it somehow, yeah.
Walter, because Walter's ego gets involved and he starts doing something crazy, like jumping out the car with shooting an Uzi. So, you know,
yeah.
Like, even when people mean well, it just always.
It just goes wrong, yeah. And so this idea of individualism was something I was thinking about. Because, you know, I mean, if you look at it, like, the dude basically just wants his rug back. It's about him. It's not really about anything else. He just kind of wants his rug back so he can chill, you know. Maude Lebowski just wants a kid. You know, she just wants a kid and her money. She's not really worried about how the dude feels.
The act of coitus.
Yep. Yeah, the act of coitus. You know, the only people who are really seem concerned with other people are the people who are presented as betas, you know. So the Donnie, you know, he seems to be genuinely, he wants to know what people are talking about. He wants to be involved. He wants friends. And, you know, his fate is a grim one. The Philip Seymour Hoffman character, Brant, you know, he seems to be genuinely concerned about, you know, the Big Lebowski's situation. And he's always kind of put down. And I'm not exactly sure what the Coen brothers are trying to say, but I think what they are trying to express is the different ways that individualism can express itself. Because on the one hand, you have the Big Lebowski, you have Jackie Treehorn, you have the people who are making a lot of money and maybe living in a way where they lack integrity, and that's how their individualism manifests itself. But then you also have people like the dude who he's just trying to do his own thing. He's just trying to be an individual, but he has some integrity about the way he does it. He's not going to screw people over, even in the situation where he ends up with the briefcase and he has an opportunity to screw someone over and make some money. He has to be talked into that by Walter, and the thing that gets him isn't that he can make money, it's that someone has screwed him over. So the only reason he's willing to compromise his morals is because he feels like it kind of karmic level even things out.
That's interesting. Like, it's a lot of the film is concerned with, like you said, individualism. Like, it's a concern with who you want to be. Like, how do you want to present yourself? Like, and how do you obtain that? Like, how do you stick to what you want? Like, the fact that the dude is a pacifist, calls himself a pacifist, but he's always getting in fights with people. I mean, sometimes even physically he's driven to that. It's almost like that conflict there of how you see yourself, but you know, outside forces in the world can change that and can be a real challenge. And I think that's what the film's about a lot. And also the Coen brothers are really good at, I think, showing different sides of things and being almost voyeuristic in a way, where they show you something, but you don't know which side they're on. They kind of play both sides. They're good at that. And I think that's at play here with the, like I said, the capitalism aspect, because you could not have two more different characters than the Big Lebowski and the Dude. And, you know, their conversations just display that. And I think, but in the end, you know, who are the Coen brothers rooting for? We don't really know, because yeah. I think there's merit to both, two things that both of them say and do. Mm-hmm. So it would be hard to say that they had like a single or a singular message they were trying to convey. Yeah. I think they're more just like showing you different types of characters, different types of situations, and mm-hmm. letting you decide, I think.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting too, because the Dude is someone who kind of totally lacks agency. Like everything that happens, as you mentioned, right, everything that happens in this movie is because of something someone else does.
Yeah.
He really doesn't do anything. In this whole movie, he's just kind of listening to what other people are mm-hmm. telling him. He's just like mm-hmm. a tumbleweed rolling along. Mm-hmm. What is interesting, some of the characters that I find interesting, just the inclusion of them, were the Nihilists. There's this one group of characters which features Flea, Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, which is kind of the ultimate 90 movies cameo. I think they're kind of interesting because I think this is a movie about philosophy.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And the fact that they would include that, because it does present such a crazy world, but at the same time, I think that maybe what is trying to be expressed is that this world, even though it seems so crazy, is really no crazier or more confusing than our own. It just seems that way because we expect order in movies in the same way we expect order in life, but when that order gets pulled out from under us, everything's... Mm-hmm. And so you can almost understand the nihilists who are saying, oh, you know... It's all absurd. It doesn't mean anything, because if I was living in this world that the Coen brothers have created, you know, where nothing seems to mean anything, everything leads to a dead end, I might hit a point too where I would say it's all meaningless. You know, I'm not gonna worry about it. You know,
still to believe in nothing so much that you actually call yourself like a name, a nihilist.
Mm-hmm.
That's to me is like they're almost like showing you the comedy there of like mm-hmm. these people are like the Dude, but not at all, because they care enough to be part of their own group or their own organization. The Dude is part of no organization. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't want to be associated with anything except maybe being a pacifist. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, so that was, I think just they show you different characters, different groups. And like you said, different philosophies, different individuals.
Mm-hmm. What did you, cause this is something we would be remiss if we didn't talk about. What did you make of the dream/drug sequence?
Well, they're very entertaining. As to their significance,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. They're very fun to watch, and I think it's definitely an opportunity for them to have a lot of visual flair, and they do some really cool stuff with the point of view of the bowling ball going mm-hmm. down the lane and things like that. And the music choices are really well done. So I enjoy them, and I think they're good. Honestly, I think they're a really good break. I think, you know, from all the plot, having those little montages there,
just letting it be kind of fun.
And the more like dream surreal, like type of images. Mm-hmm. Having that, I think it's just like, if anything for your brain, it's like your brain needs that kind of break to just, you know, be like, all right,
I'd like to watch this
for a second.
Yeah. I'd like to make an interesting claim. And sure. That is, the dream sequences are the most logical thing that happens in the entire movie.
Okay.
I'm
with you.
Like, because, and the reason for that being is things get so off the rails in real life, but in the dream sequences, you can kind of totally just vibe with the imagery. You know what I mean? It's like when you stop trying to really mm-hmm. figure out what it means and just say, oh, you know, this is just kind of his mind reacting to everything that's going on.
When you dream, it's a way for your subconscious to just process everything that you've been through. So it kind of makes sense in that way.
Yeah, it's processing. Like, and I feel like what's interesting is the rest of the movie, everything that's happening outside of the dream, the Dude is kind of doing the same thing. He's just trying to process a bunch of confusing stimuli. And I think in the dream, the fact that it just lets it go abstract, you know, the fact, like, because, and I think it's our nature as movie viewers that we're so used to looking for meaning and we're so used to looking for logic in movies and a through line, that it can be really frustrating and crazy when that doesn't happen, as it doesn't happen in The Big Lebowski. But I think the dream sequences almost are a relief when we see them, as you mentioned, because it gets so confusing at certain points that when it finally says, no, like, you don't have to worry about the logic, just enjoy the abstraction, things start to actually click a little bit more, which is interesting because I find a lot of the time I've written dream sequences, and as I'm sure most writers have, and we've all seen them, a lot of the time dream sequences are used as a tool to abstract. They're used as an expressive tool. But I think that in this particular case, the dream sequence is almost just saying, like, hey, like, calm down. Just enjoy it.
Yeah.
Like, it's all okay. It's just what it is.
When you watch this film, it's almost like you have to think like the dude.
Yeah.
Because things just happen. You just have to be like, okay, you know, go along with it. Either you're along for the ride or you're not. And in terms of motivation, I mean, like you said, people are always looking for motivation or plot elements when they're watching a film, but that is very much not important here.
No.
So you almost have to approach it like the dude would. And I think Jeff Bridges was dead on.
He's incredible.
Like I said, like with his performance and reading about the behind the scenes for this one, when he, as far as motivation goes, his biggest concern was before a scene, he would usually ask the Coen brothers, did the dude burn one on the way over? And that was pretty much it. You know, that's all he had to know. That was all, like, all he had to go off of for the scene. And that's all you need for the film. It's like, you know, you just kind of take it as it comes and see where it takes you.
Yeah. And I think the Jeff Bridges performance is a big reason why this movie has held up so well through the years. Just because that character is just so much fun to spend time with. And Jeff Bridges is such a master of his craft. Yeah. But yeah, and it's one of those things where that character so easily could have been a disaster, you know?
And yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, because if you didn't cast that role, if you didn't do it exactly like they did,
it could have been such a stereotypical stoner.
It might not have worked out. Yeah.
It could have just been a stereotypical stoner in over his head.
With Jeff Bridges, there's something else behind his eyes. You just know there's something else going on that makes him more interesting than it could have been, I think. Yeah, you're right.
Well, and once again, it doesn't seem like, as we go through the Slacker series, it doesn't seem like the dude is stupid, you know?
No.
He's not a stupid guy.
He's probably,
like,
very intelligent,
actually. Yeah, he just kind of wants to chill. And, you know, we all know people like this who are really smart but don't really have any
desire to get
it. Yeah, they don't have a desire to put it into something in particular. They just want to kind of coast and enjoy it and have their nice conversations and hang out with their friends. And I think that intelligent edge that Jeff Bridges brought to the character really opens it up. And the story of this film and its release, not the plot, but the actual story of the film itself, is kind of interesting because when this came out, you know, it did all right at the box office. It wasn't a huge hit, but it didn't totally bomb either. But it was not critically well received. A lot of people, I mean, going back to Kevin Smith, I remember hearing a quote about Kevin Smith, and he was like, you know, I got together with a bunch of friends and we were all excited. We went to see this movie, and at the end of it, we all left kind of feeling like, oh, you know, this is the kind of movie we would make. You know, this isn't like, because before that, Coen Brothers had done Fargo, you know, Barton Fink, Miller's Crossing. Like, they had done these, like,
Blood Simple,
these big, intense movies. And then all of a sudden, they're doing this, like, quirky stoner comedy. But
it's almost like a play on what they had done before.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah, it totally is. The genre conventions, yeah.
But like you said, I mean, this is a quintessential cult film because when it came out, it did okay, like you said, but it didn't. You know, it didn't set the world on fire or anything, but it was years later when people came back to it that it really it caught on and became somewhat of a cult thing, and an actual cult thing, apparently. For some people, they really take the lifestyle seriously. So it's very interesting, to see it evolve in that way. And there's Lebowski Fests that go on every year, and I think some theaters have like nightly or weekly screenings of the film. I mean, it plays all the time. Very much a cult film.
Yeah. One thing that was, I've heard this theory, and I can't find right now, I'm looking it up, who I could credit it to, but it was really interesting, was that 9/11 played really closely into the reason that this movie kind of blew up. And the idea is that in a world before 9/11, a movie like this wouldn't have been as well received because we were in a time when there was kind of more order. You know, Clinton was in the White House, things were going pretty well. And yes, it was getting like a little confusing. There was the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal. But like politically, the place that our country was at, it kind of still made sense. But post 9/11, we were in a world where nothing made sense anymore. You know, when a tragedy of that scale happens, Like, no one knows how to react to that. It's just totally unprecedented because, you know, obviously there was Pearl Harbor, but Pearl Harbor was a military operation. You know, that was part of a war. So as tragic and as awful as it was, it's still kind of, people could kind of logicalize as to why it happened. Whereas 9/11, you know, that's an attack. That's not about soldiers. That's just normal people. And so that kind of coincided with Comedy Central picking up The Big Lebowski. And I remember being, you know, I remember in the early 2000s, if you turn on Comedy Central at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 out of 5 days, The Big Lebowski would be on TV. And
like this or Strangers with Candy. That was
And I don't even think, or Kingpin. It was a bowling thing, apparently.
Yeah.
Or just if you'd put on ESPN, it would just be bowling. But but I think that there was a certain thing like about that time that everyone was just confused. I mean, I don't even think. I think I saw this movie in its entirety in little pieces on Comedy Central before I actually saw it all the way through. And because of just that constant replaying, it just became so ingrained in the zeitgeist in that way. What's interesting, though, and Mark was making this is kind of a fun little thing. It's a movie that has some kind of scandalous subject matter. You know, there's like the scenes where they're talking about porn. There's a lot of language. And it is a movie that mostly got its life going from being played on cable. And so it was edited. And Mark, if you want to kind of speak to...
All right. Yeah, we'll go into this. I think it's... there's a line. So there's a lot of, you know, there's some language in this movie. I'm not going to... If you've seen it, then you know.
You know.
And so there's one scene in particular, which is, to me, one of the funniest situations in the film where somehow, through the course of events... the dude and Walter end up at a, what is he, like 15? 15 year old.
He's supposed
house.
To be 15. He looks a little older than 15 in my opinion.
Like, they show up at this kid's house with his homework that they found because they think that that the kid stole the dude's car. So they show up with the kid's homework to confront him. And basically, the scene ends with Walter screaming at the kid and bashing a car that he believes to be the kid's car, but it's actually someone else's, and screaming, "This is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass," which is a great line, but it when they show it on TV, it gets changed to, "This is what happens when you meet a stranger in the Alps," which is great.
Yeah, which is funny.
Creative way to get around that, I guess.
But poetically, I think there's something so Big Lebowski about that. You know what
about
I mean?
That line, yeah.
Like about that line, but just about the, like, just the absurdity that we even are editing content for television in that way.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like everything, it just plays so well because it just,
such a ridiculous line to begin with.
And I go back and forth on absurdist art, you know, like if you look at the Dadaists and all that with like Duchamp putting this, which, you know, this is the second time in the course of this series where I'm bringing up Duchamp putting a toilet in an art gallery. But, you know, I think with the people we're talking about, it only makes sense because these are kind of absurdist people. You know, I personally go back and forth about how I feel about that because on the one hand, I love the idea. Well, it's like, oh, you know, life is absurd, art is absurd, and we should embrace it. But on the other hand, it's kind of like, what does that accomplish? You know, if we're not going to try.
Yeah. Well, that absurdness, I was going to bring this up, and I'm going to call it a spoiler, but again, not too much involving plot. But speaking of absurd, the fact that Donnie ends up dying in the movie, it's very... surprisingly, when you first watch the movie, you don't expect that to happen at all. But the fact that it does, it's such a random thing that happens. How do you look at that? Are the Coens making some sort of statement there, or is that just in line with the craziness that's already gone on? Or what do you
think? If the only statement is maybe at the end of the day, we just don't have control over things. You know, things are going to happen.
Even when they throw the ashes, the wind blows.
Yeah, the wind blows it back
in the dude's face, which is one of the funniest parts.
Yeah, I think that it's just this total lack of control. You know, that even a sweet character, because Donnie, I mean, realistically, these characters are all likable in the sense that they're fun to watch. But like, I don't think I would actually want to be friends with anyone in this movie except for Maude. I would want to be friends with Maude.
I would want to hang out with her.
But other than that, like, I don't think I would actually want to spend time around any of these people because your life is going to end up in a total mess. But Donnie is maybe the only character who you're like, you know, he seems like a decent guy. Like, he's maybe a little annoying. He asks a lot of questions. But like, he seems like a pretty reasonable dude. And the fact that that's the one character who at the end of the day they choose to kill off in all the craziness, you know, really it's like you kind of have to put your hands up and you say bad things will happen to people who live their lives in a good way. Good things will happen to people who live their lives in a, you know, scandalous or controversial way. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you know, death is the great equalizer and it's kind of out of our control.
Yeah, you could be a bystander and something could happen. Yeah, you just... Exactly, it's out of our control.
And it's a heart attack. There's no agency. Right. No one is making a decision to hurt Donnie. It just happens.
When I watched it this time, I actually rewound it because I was like, oh, because I figured he got shot. I forgot it was a heart attack.
It's a heart attack,
and
yeah.
I rewound it. I'm like, oh, actually, they never show anything. And then, yeah, sure enough, it's a heart attack. So it's even more random than, you know, because there's a lot of violence going on at that time where that happens. So, yeah, I think it just goes, it comes, you know, it's in line with the randomness of the film and what the Coen brothers are exploring. So I think it does make sense.
And are there any other deaths in this film? I'm trying to think. I don't think there are. Which is interesting because they're also playing off genres which are so notorious for violence.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, like, I love films noir. I've been watching a lot of them lately. And people will get murdered. Like, it's nobody's business. And there are violent moments in this movie. But, like, the fact that no one dies except for Donnie. And it's just a heart attack. And there's so many opportunities where they could have taken it to a place where things could have become violent and dark. Yeah. But really, like, at the end.